This is Courtney Draper, and you're listening to the Rated NA podcast at nerdappropriate.com.
Welcome to episode number 106 of the podcast Rated NA for the website nerdappropriate.com. This is a special one. We have an interview, and it's pretty much only an interview this time due to the two podcasts that we did this week.
We got a double feature this week.
Yes. Ooh. Double the action. So our interview is with actress Courtney Draper, who you guys may know from a little game called Bioshock Infinite, where she played the character of Elizabeth. And this one was, I always say this, so I promise I'm not just saying it this time, but this one was awesome. She is incredibly fun, and she is just a wealth of information, and just we had a genuinely amazing time talking to her.
How cool is Courtney Draper?
She's
so nice.
Cool. Super.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
I kind of love she's got so many facets, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's a voice actress, and she has some stuff coming out in the near future, and she is in law school now.
She's a singer.
She sings. She was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, season 7. To me, that is a big deal.
Well, I love her story about being on set. That was a great one.
So hang out and listen to our chat with Courtney Draper, and then we will be right back after talking to her. And we're here with actress Courtney Draper, who was, of course, the voice of Elizabeth in Bioshock Infinite. And we loved, loved, loved her work in Bioshock. And we asked her nicely to come on, and she said yes, which is great. So welcome, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's awesome. So we just like to start things off and see how our guests are doing. So what have you been up to the past couple weeks, and how's everything going, and how's life?
Life's good. Can't complain very much. The last couple weeks, I have been bunkered down doing finals for law school, so I haven't had much of a life. But I finished up about a week ago, and I've just been kind of catching up on things. Did my laundry. Pretty exciting life I'm living.
Wow.
I hadn't done laundry in like a month, so it was time. It was time.
That sounds a lot like myself.
Yes.
We actually
yeah, me too.
The law school thing, and I think that's pretty incredible because it's a really different sort of path to head down, especially for someone who has a background in acting. So I guess just kind of jumping ahead, how did you decide, or when did you decide to go ahead and do that?
I guess when I was, I don't know, a few years back, I guess it'll be about like 6 years ago, I decided to go back to school. And I'd always done kind of a class here and a class there at community college. And then, I don't know, I just really wanted to delve all the way into it. So I put acting on hold. And then I got my bachelor's degree in psychology. So I was trying to figure out if I wanted to do my PhD in psychology or if I wanted to do law school. And I had done the debate team in college, and I really, really loved it. So it kind of was just a natural next step for me, especially because there is an aspect of trial work where you're performing, you know, you're performing mm-hmm. for the jury and judge. And so I think that I was able to tap into that side of myself, which kind of kept me happy so far. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into it. And I really wanted and was craving something really intellectually stimulating and challenging. I've always kind of been a bit of an academic. So I was missing that, you know, when I was doing acting. So I went to law school and definitely have been challenged, and it's been great. I really love and enjoy the work that I'm doing, and, you know, and I get to give back and be an advocate for people that can't advocate for themselves. So I think there's a public service element that's very rewarding for me.
Oh, that's very cool. So what type of law do you plan on practicing when you're all done?
I mean, I'm still figuring it out. I have a job at a firm this summer, so we'll see how that goes. I've also worked at the DA's office.
That is.
Yeah, I did Cold Case Homicide, which was
Yeah, that is awesome.
Really fun. Oh, man.
It's a story that you're probably legally not allowed to talk about.
No, it's just really, I just find that kind of stuff really interesting. I find criminal law very, very interesting. And, you know, along the lines of being able to advocate for people that don't have the opportunity or means to advocate for themselves, you know, being a prosecutor in the district attorney's office is a great way to be of service to the community. And it also happens to be something, you know, the material of criminal law is something that I'm very, very intrigued by. So I think eventually I'll end up doing that. It's just a matter of, you know, what steps I'll take to get there.
That's awesome. That's really, really cool.
I actually have a question. So just out of curiosity's sake, if you were presented with a case, let's say you decided to go the path of criminal law and working for the DA's office, and you got a case like the Jody Arias trial, do you think that you would A, enjoy defending someone like that, or would you, you know, would you find that challenging? Like, how would you approach that?
Well, for the prosecutor, I would be trying to lock them up.
Right, so, that's true. Yeah, so okay, I messed up.
That's exactly,
why I should not be a lawyer.
No, I think, I mean, it's my fault because the jargon is second nature to me, but I didn't know who was what, and I didn't know what a prosecutor was before. So it's actually my fault. So, but that's the reason that I would, you know, I love criminal law, and you can either be a prosecutor trying to lock a person up, or can be the defense attorney. I think that's my thing, though, is that if I want to do criminal law, you know, you pick a side, and I wouldn't be able to defend someone who, you know, was a child molester or a rapist, or I don't have that in me to be able to, you know, morally and consciously develop a framework where I could do that. And I think, you know, there are people obviously that can, and you can make a lot of money being a defense attorney. But that's exactly, you know, I couldn't be able to do that, which is why I want to be a prosecutor on the other side.
Well, that's interesting. So that's cool. Interesting that you say, you know, you said advocate for someone who isn't able to do that. And I think I messed up in my head, but that's actually a really cool way to look at a victim. You know what I mean? So you're advocating for someone who, you know, has been, you know, hurt or dead, or you know, right. What I mean, so that's actually pretty cool. I've never thought about a prosecutor that way, so that's interesting.
Yeah, I you know, it's funny because I have some family friends that you know, some neighbors of mine that have lived down the street from my parents for years and years, and you know, they had a really big tragedy happen to their daughter, and I was listening to this story, which is just an incredible story in itself. But I was watching the way that it's this horrible, tragic story. But then every time the woman, the mother, who's our neighbor, when she would speak about the prosecutor, her face would just light up. And she was just like, yeah, like she really fought for us. And I just thought, how amazing that out of this horrible situation, you look at the prosecutor as your personal advocate and as your the person who is seeking justice on behalf of your family. And that was kind of the turning point where I remember just watching her tell her story, and it just brought tears to my eyes. And I thought, God, like, that's what I want to do. I want to use these skills that I have to be able to bring that kind of peace and strength to a family. And
that's incredible. I've actually never looked at it that way. And you really
I haven't either.
You know, if you have that mindset when you're actually going into this new career, I mean, you really are, I mean, not to sound cheesy, but you really are going to be a hero to people. I mean, you're going to defend people that need defending and in a way save the day. So that's a really, really admirable thing, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, you know, lawyers get a bad rep, obviously. So I think it was really important for me that I have a passion for being an advocate, and I have a passion for, I've always done like charity work and been really involved in trying to give back to my community. And this was, it's really important for my life to have meaning and my work to have meaning and not just get, you know, sucked in by how much money can I make in this field. Mm-hmm. And I mean, being a prosecutor, you're working for, you know, you're working for the state, so you're definitely not making a lot of money. And it was just important for me to find, like, what's the best avenue for me to be fulfilled in what I'm doing? And this, you know, this is definitely what I think it's going to be, is being a prosecutor. So I mean, we'll see.
Out of curiosity, what would you have pursued if you decided to go for a PhD in psychology? Would you have done something like clinical or?
Yeah, I was really interested in clinical psychology, but the thing that I realized is that I wasn't really interested in research. And, you know, especially coming out of UCLA, it's a huge research institution. And that's where I got my undergrad from. And so many psychologists also do, you know, they're also in academia and doing research.
Oh, I know.
And I just really, yeah, I just really did, I really didn't enjoy that side of it. So then I was thinking about, you know, I really wanted to do something like forensic psychology because I was really interested in, in like abnormal psychology. And so I was thinking about, you know, doing something like that. But the schooling and that would have been required, I just felt like law was a better fit for me.
That's cool. Awesome. Absolutely. That's really, really cool. I think Scott's feeling the burn right now because he's been doing a lot of research for many years. So he's like, I need to get out of here.
No, I mean, I feel like some people really love it, you know, and it just wasn't something that I had a passion for.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
it's just finishing is what's challenging. So good luck to you in the law school endeavor for sure. Yeah.
Thanks.
Let's dive back to sort of your origin, which is what we do here. And we talked briefly before we started recording, but you were born in Orlando where the original members of our podcast are from Orlando. So you were born here. And do you actually still frequent here? Do you come back? Do you ever visit our hot and spread hot out town?
Yeah, you know, I used to go back. So my biological father and my three sisters and brother live there. So I used to go back, you know, as often as I could, you know, when I was younger and into my teenage years, I'd probably, you know, I'd go back for all my breaks for school and holidays. And then when I was older, I was dating someone that lives in Orlando. So I was going back like 3 or 4 times a year. And at this point in my life, like with law school and you know, I'm traveling a lot. My sisters and my brother are older, so they've come out to see me. So I don't go back as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. But I definitely was going back and forth pretty regularly, you know, up until the last few years.
Yeah, yeah. So, because we know that after digging into your background, you were on a show called, I know, this always sounds creepy when I say it, when we were researching you, like, it's horrible, but so, you know, we do our research, but you were on a show called The Jersey for quite some time, and I didn't actually know if that filmed here in town or not.
It filmed in, I think, in Culver City.
Oh, okay, in Culver.
Yeah, so it was in Los Angeles.
Gotcha. And that, of course, was a show about a magical jersey that could sort of quantum leap you into different bodies, different...
Yeah, it was based on nonfiction, and... No, it was cool. It was like a quantum leap, but for kids. And
I missed that show. I never actually caught it. So when I was like reading about it, I'm like, I would have loved this when I was a kid. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. It was fun. I mean, we had all these, you know, athletes that would come on the show, and yeah, it was a really cool experience.
That's very cool. One thing I did totally geek out about. I am an unabashed fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes.
And then I learned after creeping on you that you were one of the potential slayers. And I
was. Like,
and I was like, holy shit. I'm like, I had no idea that that was you.
I was a dum-dum and I got scared and ran away and then I got slaughtered.
You were one of the first to die, right?
Oh, yeah. I think I was the first to die.
That's kind of an honor, right? The first, first of the potential slayers to get killed.
I think I got killed like in an alley or by a dumpster or something.
Yeah, it's very sad. So do you have any memories of actually shooting that, or was it just too long ago to actually?
I mean, I think that I just remember that it was really, really – oh, did you just hear my email go off? I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
That's okay.
It happens to us all the time.
My professor just emailed me and it popped up. Let me close it out actually so it doesn't happen again. I forgot my little – okay, sorry.
No worries.
Yeah, so – I mean, all I remember is that, like, the scenes, it would take, because I worked on The Bold and the Beautiful before that, and we would literally film an entire half-hour episode in, you know, a day, in, like, 5 or 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So when I went to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know, it was an hour show, obviously, and they would take, like, a week or two to film it, and it just felt so slow to me, and I just remember from what I had come from previously to going to that, it just, I couldn't believe how much of a difference it was.
Yeah.
And I remember that. I remember how beautiful Sarah Michelle Gellar was in person. And I remember her reading, she was an avid reader, and I remember talking to her about books, and she was reading the biography of Frida Kahlo at the time, the one that was made into the movie with Selma Hayek.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what I think she was reading it before that happened, but yeah, she was reading that book, and I ended up like reading it after her, and that's pretty much everything I remember from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's still a pretty awesome memory. I do remember reading that she actually collects old books and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's her big passion, is getting, like, you know, ancient books and keeping them around, which is neat. Well, that's cool that you remember that. I mean, that's still one of my favorite shows of all time. And like when I did that connection and realized you were on it, I was like, oh, that's just really, really neat.
It's funny to like talk to, you know, a lot of people that was, you know, that show was really, really, really something that they loved. And so it's cool to hear that, you know, because I never really watched it that much growing up. Mm-hmm. But it's cool to be on something that was such a huge phenomenon and that people really love and feel a connection to.
Absolutely. Especially now that Joss Whedon is so admired at this point in his career. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the past, it's like you'd say, oh, you know, I was a fan of Firefly and I'm a fan of Buffy. And people are like, oh, you know, okay. Now, right. Like, the guy is, you know, kind of a big deal, so
yeah.
So that's it is nice to see some love coming this way.
You're a puppy.
Oh, sorry, that's my puppy.
Yeah. y'all have dogs, so you might hear them from time to time.
Yes, it's true.
Speaking dog languages. So we have to obviously talk to you about BioShock Infinite, because all of us here have played it and all of us have beaten it, so if we talk about spoiler stuff, we'll warn the listeners. But first of all, you did an absolutely incredible job, and we're not just saying that. We are huge gamers, everyone here on the show, and we are big fans of voice acting as well, and we've had a lot of voice actors on the show. But your work really, really stood out, because it was incredibly passionate, and the character of Elizabeth was very, very, very well-rounded. And by the end of the game, you felt in love with Elizabeth. At least most people that played through BioShock Infinite fell in love with Elizabeth. So when you were approached by Irrational, were you familiar with the franchise? I mean, were you aware kind of what BioShock was, and really how did you get pulled into this role at all?
Well, first of all, thank you for everything that you just said.
I was really long-winded.
I know, right?
No, it means so much to me when I hear people, especially when you say that, you know, it was such a passionate performance, because I put everything that I had into that. So it's nice to hear that people understand and get that emotion from it and feel a connection to her, because I mean, that's, you know, what more can you ask for when you put forth, you know, any sort of art or work product. Okay. So when I first found out about the game, I wasn't a huge gamer outside of Super Mario Brothers 3, which I still play.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I didn't, I didn't really get, you know, all the new consoles came out and I pretty much had a Nintendo and that was it. So I was a little stuck in time, and specifically, what was it, 1987 or 1988, whatever year that came out. But I had a friend who was really, really good friend of mine named Keon Shokray, and he's a really big gamer and knew a lot about the franchise. So when I told him, you know, I knew that I was going in for this game, and I said, hey, you know, what do you know about this franchise, you know, BioShock? You know, what do you know about it? Tell me what you know. And he said, oh my gosh, like, this AAA title, like, this is amazing, you know, technologically or technologically.
Yeah,
make me sound smart. No. No, technologically, the work that they're doing is, you know, really innovative. They have great storytelling. Their narrative is very impressive. And so he kind of gave me the backbone for what BioShock was in the gaming industry, and kind of not only in the gaming industry, but just in the field of entertainment in general, kind of where it fit. And he said, you know, if you work with Ken Levine, that's like working for the Steven Spielberg of gaming. Like, you know,
sure.
They're like, this is an incredible opportunity. And so I kind of got pumped, because I was like, okay, this seems like a really good project. And that was kind of my introduction to the franchise. And then when I went for my callback and I got to meet Troy Baker, who played Booker DeWitt, you know, he was really filling me in. And then I met Ken, and Ken was saying what, you know, all the new things and the direction they were going to go in with this game and how different it was from everything that was out there. So by the time I left my second callback in Boston, I knew that I mean, I was salivating over this role, and I really, really wanted it. And I reached out to Joe Fielder, who was a writer and producer on the show, or excuse me, on BioShock. And I told him, you know, I want this job. I'm very passionate about this project. I want to be a part of this, and I, you know, I'll do whatever it takes. And I definitely made my intentions known, because it was at that point between me and one other actor who had more gaming experience. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of, you know, my introduction to BioShock. And, you know, by the time that I left, I knew it was going to be amazing, and I wanted to be on board with that and be a part of it.
That's incredible. I mean, it you know, obviously, like I said earlier, all of us are huge fans of the franchise. And then once you were done, once we, you know, we saw your work, we became huge fans of you as well. So it's cool that you were so, you know, like we said earlier, passionate about actually getting the work and you know, and being a part of the project. How long, because I know the production of Infinite was, it had a long, long production cycle, and people were scared for a while. they were really scared. Everyone was like, is this game going to be shit? And I'm like, probably not. It's probably not going to be, it'll probably be okay. I like when games take a long time, because normally, I mean, from my experience, just as a gamer, it means they're really, a lot of the time, trying very hard, right? Yeah.
They really polish. Yeah.
Polish is important. But how long did it take you, actually? How long did you work on Infinite? Do you remember?
I started working on it about 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, obviously the game came out in March. And then I, you know, if you include the last few months since the game came out, in total it's been 2.5 years since I first started recording for it.
That's incredible. And we know that they brought you to PAX this year, right? To East. You were at East, correct? PAX East?
I did PAX East this year.
How was that? Because we were there, but we didn't see you. We couldn't get near because the BioShock stuff was nuts, and we couldn't even go anywhere close to it. So
I think they had people lining up since like 8 or 9 in the morning. I mean, it was insane. No, PAX, I mean, it was great. It was the first time that I got to see people cosplaying as characters from, you know, from BioShock Infinite, which was amazing because the game hadn't even come out yet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's
and to see, you know, I got to take a picture. You know, we had like a fan party, and people that were cosplaying got invitations to it when, you know, some of the people from BioShock Infinite were walking around the floor, and they would see them and give them a pass to it. And so we had all of these people dressing up. Probably 20 or 30 people were at that fan party, and it was just amazing to see such excitement for the game that hadn't even come out yet. I mean, the game could have been crap, and just to see that people were already that excited about it was really awesome for me, because I've never really done a game where that has happened.
That's cool. Do you think that, I mean, even though you're busting your ass in law school now, do you think you might frequent conventions, like go back and see your fans and see the gaming community, because they probably would love to see you?
Yeah. No, I definitely want to, you know, this has been a whole new world that's been exposed to me, and I really have such excitement and respect for the gaming community. And I think that there's one aspect of it that, especially with games like BioShock coming out that are really narrative driven, mm-hmm. the technology was so new and innovative. And so from an intellectual standpoint, I think it's really great to be part of a community that's like that. I mean, if you look at film and television, it's not as technically innovative. Maybe it is, and I haven't been exposed to it, but it seems like people that are watching movies and television don't want to be as stimulated necessarily, mm-hmm. or the gaming community seems to really embrace these changes that are happening. And really, I mean, just the success of BioShock, I think, shows that the gaming community they want their minds blown.
Yeah,
and I think that that's awesome, because I think it's taking the gaming industry in a really, really, a really, really good direction, and a really, really intelligent direction, which, you know, just from someone that is very academic, I'm drawn to. And then you have the passion for the narrative, and the fan base is just incredible. And it's exciting to be around people.
It is. It is neat. Like, it's true. I love that you said the things that you said, because I'm a huge advocate for the way games are transforming. I've been playing games since I was a little kid, and people that listen to this show will probably be sick of me saying this, but in the past 5 or 6 years, I've seen such a change in the quality of narrative and the quality of games. You really do have these incredible experiences. And, you know, there were times when I was playing BioShock Infinite and my wife was laughing at me hysterically because I would stand up off the couch and point at the screen with my mouth open and be like, oh my God, like when the rips in space opened and there was, you know, music from the 80s coming through the rips in space. I almost shit my pants because I was just so it was so cool to me as a fan of science fiction and a fan of all that kind of stuff. I hadn't ever experienced anything like that in a game before. So I think games have gotten amazing. And, you know, as an actor, I really feel like, you know, it must be very exciting to be a part of this new medium. I mean, really, I think modern games are a new medium of storytelling. So,
yeah, well, I definitely agree with you. Yeah.
So thank I you. Think a lot of the agency is on the player inside of the games, which to your point, Courtney, you said that, you know, maybe perhaps watching TV isn't as immersive as playing a game. So one thing that I really, really loved about your character was that I actually believed that she was from that time. So I thought you did a fantastic job, you know, really kind of putting yourself into, you know, a 1912 version of Elizabeth. So did you do any research or anything to like kind of find out, you know, more about that time, or did you read anything? I'm just really curious because you did a really good job doing that.
Thank you. I mean, I think, you know, I watch a lot of, not necessarily the 1920s, but just period pieces in general. And I mean, there's definitely a different cadence and a different tonality with which, you know, people, obviously, especially women, spoke back then. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, my love for that kind of already gave me exposure. And like, I didn't just like walk in tabula rasa. And then, you know, Ken, his writing, obviously the way that he would write kind of lent itself to that 1920s cadence, I guess. But even Ken would go in and out of it. And I kind of wrapped my mind, like just a small thing, just like contractions. I mean, people didn't speak mm-hmm. in contractions. And so even when Ken would write contractions, you know, I would say, hey, you know, I don't, especially in the beginning of the game, like, I don't think that Elizabeth would say, you know, I can't do that versus I cannot do that. So when it was appropriate for her to be a little more proper, we would try to, you know, take out the contractions. Mm-hmm. But then as you go a little deeper in the game and she gets less formal, then I'm sure that there are some thrown in there. But I mean, that's just a small example of things to be conscious of.
No, that's really cool. So in the booth, you were kind of giving feedback on how you felt Elizabeth would approach things.
Oh, definitely. It's funny. That's because, awesome. I mean, I don't know if this is necessarily true, but you know, Ken would tell me, he told me multiple times, like, you know, what do you think? I mean, you know Elizabeth better than I do.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It's cool that he, you know, that he would, first of all, that he would be humble enough to even ask what we think. Because a lot of people, directors, writers, they don't want to know what the actors think. And I think, you know, secondly, just to have us be such a collaborative process was really exciting to be a part of something like that. And a very different approach than, especially with voiceover, where you're usually isolated from each other. So, so yeah, I think it was really cool on a lot of different levels. And it was definitely, him and Troy and I would all workshop together and really just figure these characters out so that as the player, when you're walking through the, or sprinting through the game, however you chose to play, you really felt like your situations were organic and you have a connection, and we wanted people to fall in love with Elizabeth the way that we did. And it was very important that we be mindful of interactions and we be mindful of experiences in the game feeling organic, and we be mindful of, you know, expositional stuff not feeling expositional, so that when Elizabeth says something like, oh, hey, you know, I think I saw an ammo shop back there, that the player doesn't think, oh, I'm being told to go back there. That the player really feels like they can make their own decision about what they want to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And especially we didn't want, as a companion character, that, you know, you're with almost the entirety of the game. We really wanted to be mindful that Elizabeth didn't seem annoying. And you know, that, especially in the beginning scenes when she's really naive, that was something that we had to adjust and alter because she, you know, we didn't want the player to think, oh God, like this, you know, when can I get rid of this girl? Yeah. Or like turn their gun on her, you know?
And actually that's a perfect transition into our next question because I don't know if you had an opportunity to see any of the press that came out before the game was released, but a lot of the press really did focus on the character of Elizabeth. And it really did seem like before the game's release that the success or failure of this game would sort of hinge upon Elizabeth and your connection with her and your ability to believe that this collection of pixels was an actual person that you would care about. And I think, right. I mean, obviously now it was extremely successful and you did a wonderful job. And, you talked about it a little bit, but, you know, not only was it successful, but, a lot of people sort of regard Elizabeth as one of the best sidekicks in video game history. And it kind of stems from, you know, her
second to Mass Effect is what I always hear.
we're big Mass Effect fans.
We are Mass Effect fans. We're not gonna make anybody pick sides.
There's usually that disclaimer, but no, I'm just teasing. I
yeah, but it, you know, from simple things like you said, like, you know, giving you money from time to time, helping you find items, like staying out of the way during combat. It's so easy in video games when you play as much as we do to see these companion characters and just sort of ignore them or become, right, you know, frustrated with them. And I really feel like, you know, something special happened with Elizabeth. What, you know, what do you think it was in particular about Elizabeth that so many people could identify with or connect to?
The correct answer is my acting.
Yeah. It was kind of like I think
the first thing is just from a technical standpoint. I mean, at PAX East, we had a panel on this about the women behind BioShock. And for me personally, that was really eye-opening because you see from a developer standpoint everything technically that they had to do in order to make her the kind of companion character that didn't get in your way. I mean, just logistically trying to create her that way and creating her so that if she sees something like a real person would, she goes over and she glances at it. And if it's something that the player wants to move on quickly, that she doesn't linger and hold the player up. I mean, just from a technical standpoint, there were so many aspects that had to go into her where the developers, you know, and Ken tells the story where the developers said, you know, we should just scrap her. Like, she doesn't seem like a real person. She's stilted. She gets in the way. She's stiff. She's annoying, whatever. You know, let's just scrap her. And Ken said, no, like, Elizabeth, he always knew, like, Elizabeth is going to be something really special and unique, and it's gonna work. And so I think just his genius to be able to, you know, create a character like that that has never really been done before. So I think that perseverance, and from a technical standpoint, those elements were really important so that the player wasn't annoyed by her.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I also noticed that when Elizabeth is talking to you, like she makes eye contact with you and she looks right at you, and sort of when you deliver, you know, when you bring Elizabeth to life, it really does sound like you are talking to the person on the other side of the TV. And I think that really helps establish that really strong connection throughout the game.
I think, and I really, you know, I never had really thought about this before, but I think just the way that we recorded, like Troy and I were all, I mean, 99.9% of the time, we were together when we were recording.
Oh, that's awesome.
A lot of games and voiceover, you're isolated from each other.
It's rare to work in the same room at the same time. Oh, definitely. Or so we hear, yeah.
So to be able to have that, I think, is what makes everything feel so organic and you feel like you're really connecting, because it was really Troy and I in a room looking at each other while we talked to each other. And, you know, I think just that in itself makes things feel more natural. But yeah, I think Elizabeth is she's a complex character. She has feelings that every human being feels. I mean, yeah, maybe we don't have a giant mechanical bird trying to capture
it. Let's hope not, because that would be very bad.
But I think what made her so unique and so special was that she had this strength, but also this vulnerability. And you kind of see her go from a very naive girl into someone who becomes almost hardened and bitter, and then back to someone who, you know, spoiler alert, is willing to sacrifice her own existence in order to be able to save her people. And I think her story is just intriguing, and the way that Ken wrote her and wrote her character arc, you know, I think people can relate to her and relate to her struggles. And she just is showing little clips of real emotion that everyone has. And I think that's what makes her relatable.
Absolutely. And probably one of my favorite moments was the guitar scene with the yeah. Circle Be Unbroken scene. Once that scene happened, that was another one of the scenes where I stood up off the couch and was like pointing at the TV, like, what is happening right now?
It was a turning point in the game.
Anytime, it really was. Like, I've played, I don't even know how many first person shooters. I mean, I've been playing them my whole life, and never has the main protagonist picked up a guitar and had an impromptu jam session that was so, it was incredible though. And it was so heartfelt. And then we learned, of course, that you had a great singing voice, and it was an awesome moment. How did that scene and the scene, of course, you know, the full versions at the end credits. But how did that scene come to life?
It's so funny because I don't know if Ken knew how special that scene was going to be. I mean, he said to me once, you know, do you sing? And I said, yeah, you know, I can sing. And he said, why don't you send me some stuff of you singing? I think we're going to try to, you know, write it right. And then he described the scene. I think we're going to write something like that in. So I sent him some stuff and he was like, wow, like, you know, let's do this. Let's make this work. And so then, and I think what works about that scene too is that you really have to go looking. You have to be exploring the world in order to come across that. Mm-hmm. It's not like mm-hmm. a cut scene where you're just like forced into it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what makes it really cool too. It's kind of like this little hidden gem that you stumble across. And so yeah, so that's kind of how it came about. And then I've had a lot of people tell me that that's their favorite moment in the game.
It's pretty incredible. It really is.
Yeah, it really is.
It means a lot to me because that was, you know, my grandfather was passed. He was dying of Alzheimer's or dementia. And I was flying back and forth from LA to Colorado. And I basically, the last time that I said, you know, went to the hospice and said goodbye to him, I flew directly to record that scene. Oh, and wow. So I get there and Ken says, hey, check it out. I want you to sing this song. And I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Like, wow. Really? And so I, you know, the first time I started singing, I just broke down and, you know, and he kind of knew what was going on with my grandfather. And he said, look, like, I think this could be something really incredible. You know, I hate to ask this of you, but can you just give me everything you've got?
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, let's do this. And we were recording it. And I mean, bawling while we were doing it. Like, I mean, not pretty crying, like snot running down my face. Like I was a mess. Wow. And then I remember the first time we recorded it and the room was just silent. And everyone, I think after a couple moments, someone said, wow, like this is going to be really incredible. And then, you know, we recorded a few more times. And so it means a lot to me when people say that was the best moment of the game for me, because personally, I mean, I gave everything, you know, it was a hard time for me. And that song is so, it's so sentimental and has now become a part of my personal story. Mm-hmm. So it's rewarding for me when what I gave emotionally makes people feel the way that they feel. It's good for me.
Well, it was great. So thank you for doing it. Yes. we all really, really loved it. So, you know, you did an incredible job with that. We have some questions from our community to fly through. The first one is from Justin D, who is at Jushin on Twitter. And he wants to know, and these are always hard, what your favorite line was from BioShock Infinite. If you can think of one. If you can't, say I'll think of it later and we'll come back to it. Because those favorite questions are hard.
I like the line. I like when Elizabeth started to get sassy. So when she says, I might be misquoting my own alternate version of myself. But when she says, well, I want a puppy, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get one. Like, I really like that line because I find it's such a modern sarcasm for her to be exhibiting. So I like when she got sassy. So that was probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, that was a great line. I agree. Hillary, you want to ask this one?
Yeah, no problem. So Andrew Baker at A Baker N7 says, probably asked and answered, But after such an amazing performance, why leave voice acting? Any plans to return?
I think, you know, it's funny because I thought that acting wasn't for me. And I think I said that at a panel, which ended up on my Wikipedia page. But after doing BioShock, it's really been invigorating and has kind of rekindled my passion. And voiceover work is so cool, especially gaming, because of the community and because of just the passion and excitement and the fan base. It really makes me want to continue it. So I have recorded voices in two more games that
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
So that's exciting. So hopefully I'll be able to talk about that soon so I can, you know, tell people. But
definitely come back and talk to us.
Yeah,
yes, please.
I've done that. So that's going to be coming out, and, you know, hopefully more work will be coming my way. I'm really excited about it. I'm open to, you know, whatever happens. Obviously, you know, I need to finish law school because it would be crazy if I just left now.
Absolutely.
But I have been doing more stuff, and I definitely plan on doing that in the future if people are interested.
Very cool. Very cool.
Robert Freemring, who is a longtime listener of ours, he's at Mr. Slick on Twitter. He says, with working in both on-screen acting and voice acting, do you enjoy one more than the other?
I think that, you know, every medium I've worked in I've learned really unique things from. The thing that I love about voiceover work is I feel like it's so freeing, and I really get to just, you know, you're running and you're jumping and you're screaming and you're crying, and you can only do that vocally. So I think it's challenging in that way, but it also requires that you literally give 100% of yourself 100% of the time. And because, you know, you can't rest on, oh, well, if my emotion isn't there, I can, you know, scrunch my face like I'm crying or whatever the tricks of the trade are. And you know, I really enjoy that because I love just getting my hands dirty and giving everything. And I also love the fact that it's freeing physically for me because it doesn't matter what I look like or how thin I am.
You don't even have to shower before you go into the booth.
Yeah.
You can just show up in your pajamas.
Yeah, I mean, I like that. It has nothing to do with the superficial. It has everything to do with the emotion that you're giving and what you're bringing to the table in that aspect. So I respect and I love that facet of voice work.
We have been told that the microphone does not lie, and it's it's very hard to, you know, you really do have to put, you know, everything you have into it because everything comes across like in the performance.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. And I've never heard that, but it makes me laugh because it's true. I mean, you have nothing else to fake it. You know, you have one medium through which to conduct everything, and that's your voice.
Yes.
So. I want to say that might have been Jennifer Hale.
I think it may have been Allie Hillis.
It might have been Allie Hillis. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it was definitely Allie.
I misquoted the person. So that's incredible. So we have some silly questions. I don't know if you're prepared for these silly questions, but
okay.
We're going to ask them anyway.
I don't know if I am. Now I'm nervous, but okay, go.
No, they're not bad questions. They're just silly. Question is, if you had the ability to tear rifts into time and space, where would you go and what would you do?
Oh,
that's a hard question.
That's brutal.
It's kind of like if you could have, you know, dinner with one dead person.
I know, right? Like, I know.
Jesus.
Maybe you could go to an alternate universe.
Yeah. You know, actually, that's a really good idea. Because I think, you know, aside from like I'd go to biblical times and see if God's real, you know, all those things.
Yeah.
The Big Bang, I don't know. I think that aside from the typical answers, it would be really cool to see, to if you can go through a tear into an alternate universe. I mean, what a fucking trip that would be.
Yeah.
I don't know if I, like, my mind would be blown and I wouldn't come back, or I'd probably come back and people would think I was like, look at that hippie who did too much acid. Like, crazy. Doesn't happen. But yeah, I mean, that would be really cool. I also really love, like, the flapper period. And
yes, that would be so incredible.
I think it's just where women really were becoming liberated and the glamour of it. I mean, I think it's an amazing period in time. So that would be secondary to jumping through.
Sort of like a Gatsby-esque place to go.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Ironically, I'm going to go see that movie today. But yes.
Fantastic.
Nice. Let us know how it is. I haven't seen it yet. Scott or Hillary, do you guys want to answer this question? Because now I'm kind of intrigued. You guys have an answer?
The risks into time question?
Yeah, yeah. I want to know what you guys would pick.
I'm going to let Scott go first.
Well, I already took his answer.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we work together on the answer.
I kind of have one. I was just thinking about it. So my grandfather, he fought in World War II, and he lived through the war, but he didn't do anything exciting. He was in Burma building the Burma Road, and before he got drafted to fight in World War II, he was a professional baseball player. So I'd kind of like to just hang out with him, and just because he didn't get killed in the war, so I could just go kind of, you know, experience that the emotion of the war without getting shot. I don't want to fight in the war. I just want to kind of see it and hang out with my grandpa. So that's what I would choose.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay, I did think of an answer while you were while you had yours. Okay, and I know this is gonna, for anyone that listens, they'll be like, oh, of course. But I think I would tear open a rift and go into a parallel universe where the promise of what they wanted the future to be like in the 50s actually came to pass.
Oh, so you want
that's a deep answer.
I did not say the word Epcot, but it's, you know, it's the whole idea if retro futurism actually took off, like that's what I want to hear. Flying cars, Jetsons, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that'd be pretty incredible.
Well, they're actually working on robots that can, I honestly think people might think I'm an idiot after I say this. I think that everything in the Jetsons is going to come true. I really do believe. Okay, that maybe I sound crazy, but
no. Actually, Scott is the right person to talk to you about that.
you could be right.
I mean, they're already working on like the robots and the capabilities that they have, and I mean, I think it's going to happen.
I just might happen to do stuff like that.
We will time travel together, you and I.
Okay, let's go. That sounds good.
Hang out, see some future robots.
Yep. I think for my answer, I think I'm torn. So part of me, probably the writerly side of me, immediately goes, I want to see Jane Austen times. But the fact that that's already happened is kind of like, yeah, okay, I can read books about that. So I think for my answer, I'd want to go into the future when like space colonization is happening, if we actually make it, or go to a parallel universe that allows that to happen and actually get to explore the universe as our future humans probably hopefully will.
Cool and scary. I'd be like too chicken to do that.
Yeah, it is a little scary.
Well, I mean, by then hopefully they would have like ironed out the details.
Yeah, let's hope so.
I wouldn't necessarily want to do that today, but
maybe if the way you got to your moon base was to take a flying seat out of the top of a lighthouse to get there.
Exactly. And hopefully wouldn't be reading like scary messages and seeing lots of blood on your way up there.
Yes, exactly.
Very true.
It's really funny.
All right. So more ridiculous questions. This one you can just answer in a word or a sentence, but what is your favorite snack?
Oh my gosh.
It's hard, right?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm kind of a foodie. So
you like good food.
I like good food, but my favorite snack right now is ceviche. I've been like making a lot of ceviche at home, and I love seafood, and it's so easy. So I think my favorite current snack is ceviche. I'm trying to think of like something.
Do you have like a guilty pleasure snack?
I mean, I kind of just indulge in that all the time. Like I love chocolate. I love, you know, cakes and cupcakes and ice cream and, you know, all that good stuff. Cool. There was a sandwich I had when I was a little girl called a Fluffernutter. And you know that marshmallow cream?
I remember those sandwiches, yep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like a crunchy peanut butter on a sandwich. Yes. Oh, and then there are these things my mom makes. You know, she's from Allentown and they used to make them there, where you would take two waffles and you would toast them, and then you would put, what's that, Napoleon ice cream, the one with chocolate.
Very yum.
And then powdered sugar on top. And that was just.
And it's healthy too.
Right.
And good for you.
This sounds
amazing.
Yeah, it's really healthy. It's got, you get all your food groups in there. It's good.
Yeah, there's calcium.
Right. Lots and lots of calcium.
And no calories either.
Fats.
So, yeah. So those are probably two of my like childhood ones that I really love, and then the current trend.
Nice, nice. All right, so we have to ask you, favorite method of time travel. Do you want to travel in a phone booth, Bill and Ted style? Do you want to open rifts in time with magical abilities, or perhaps a DeLorean? Or if you had to choose, this is such a stupid question. I'm sorry. Like,
yeah, Ash, where'd you go on this one?
I actually think it's really interesting. I was like, oh, I hope I, you know, can answer this. I think the DeLorean, the G-Force would probably feel sick from that, assuming that there would be G-Force. I think that the phone booth would be pretty cool, but maybe a little dirty.
Yeah,
that's true.
So I'm gonna go with option B, which is the going through, you know, a la Elizabeth. If I can pretty much become real life Elizabeth, my dreams have come true.
That's awesome.
So I would definitely choose that.
I think if you were to show up in cosplay to like PAX West, it would just people's heads would explode.
Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh, right?
Well, that's what I'm going to do for Halloween. Is I'm going to dress up like Elizabeth.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
I'm really excited. That's I'm going to try to convince my boyfriend Kevin to dress up like Booker.
Oh, yes. Guys,
they do it.
Oh, you have to
take
do
lots
it.
Of pictures. People will flip out.
Oh, it's going to be. It'll be fun.
You can just throw shit at him all night and be like, catch, and just like. You know, throw a sandwich at him.
Need some money? That was my favorite, actually. I always loved it when you gave me money.
I know. I've been playing the game, obviously. So I love when I'm about to die and she goes, here's some, you know, I run out of salts and she throws me salts or throws me ammo. And I'm like, thank you, Elizabeth. Like, I get why people
don't
feel
joyful. That's why we love her.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
She's handy. Okay, so we do what we call the nerd appropriate signature question, and we ask this of everybody we have on. And the question is, what is your secret nerdy hobby or passion, either something you collect or something that you secretly do that you don't really tell a lot of people about, or maybe something that you collect? I think we had some people that collected floaty pens, and I don't know. So it's sort of a strange question because it's normally things people don't talk about. So do you have a secret nerdy hobby or passion?
I know I do, and I have a lot of them, but I can't, because when you ask me that, I have things in my brain that want to surface and I can't access them. Let me think for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of am a bowler. I've been on bowling leagues since I was like 9 years
perfect.
Old.
See, that's the perfect answer.
I've met my ex-boyfriend on a bowling league.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
So that's something that I definitely love. Our recent team that we had was called Three Pins and a Lady because it was three guys and me. And we lost.
I love it.
Yeah, we made it into the finals. I mean, we were the underdog. No one thought we were going to make it. I mean, I have my own bowling ball, my own shoes, my own glove. Like, I'm ready to rock and roll.
That's amazing. And
yeah, I love bowling so much. I mean, my mom, you know, she was on the bowling team for the Navy. And, you know, my mom's family comes from the East Coast. So they're all bowlers. They all are on bowling leagues together. And so I just kind
I
of grew
that.
Up. Yeah, really, I grew up bowling and eating pierogies in the bowling alley.
That is a great answer. That is a perfect awesome. Answer. Bowling and eating pierogies. That's,
yeah.
Is your family Polish?
Well, they're Pennsylvania Dutch.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, I mean, kind of. by where they live, but.
Well, next time you and your boyfriend come to Orlando, we will take you bowling.
For real.
I would love that. I haven't gone in a while because I hurt my back and I can't like lift and twist anything, but I miss it. So that's my nerdy thing that I like to do that most people laugh at me for.
That is amazing.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. Well, we're nearing the end of our annoying questions. So,
yeah, it was
where
fun.
Can people find you on Twitter and things of that nature? So, what is your Twitter handle for our listeners?
My Twitter handle is Courtney Courtnee _ Draper Draper, because someone took my name and impersonated me.
Of course.
Wow.
So by the time I joined Twitter, I was like, what? So I had to like file all this paperwork and now they're bumped off, but I can't get my own name. So that's frustrating.
Yeah, that is
but you can get verified and then everybody will know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think you just have to like, they have to just think you're important enough to get verified and that I'm not important enough yet.
Well, we think
it's such important. We think you are, but it's such a weird system that verified.
I don't know if it's – I think part of it is just random and part of it is like, okay, how much activity is this person getting you know, an abnormal amount of activity in a short amount of time. I don't really know how they judge it.
Mm-hmm. No, I had a friend show me profiles because he just got verified. And, you know, it was kind of like, oh, wow, congratulations. And then he was like, yeah, but I'm finding all these people who have like 10 followers that are verified. And I'm like, I don't understand. This really? Is so bizarre. Yeah, I don't know what their system is, but whatever.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. All I know is I'm not verified. And that once I am, or if I ever get verified, I will be part of the most elite club, and I will feel like I finally made it.
You can run out and get a blue check mark tattoo.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, have that like blue blob with a check mark, and I'll be like, yes, this is happening.
Validation.
It's a blue blob or something, right? What does it look like?
I think it's like a blue circle with a check or something like that.
Oh my gosh,
I just have one,
so I don't know.
I just went to your Twitter. Did you changed your hair? Is that that's what you did?
Oh yeah,
that's awesome.
A bit of an identity crisis.
It looks really great.
Thank you. Yeah, sometimes I think like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. But then I go out in the world and girls are like, wow, that's crazy and how ballsy. But I went to Vegas and you know I was getting ID'd and I was like, look, like. Yeah. Here's my driver's license, but I don't know if it's going to be that helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, I cut off, you know,
now, right?
It all off and dyed it blonde. And that's my boyfriend, awesome. You know, gets to feel like he has a new girlfriend. So it's a win-win.
That's really awesome.
Well, Courtney, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Do you have any projects or anything coming up that you want to plug? Or
Not really. I mean, I'm doing, you know, I have those games, but I can't like, I'm not allowed to talk about that yet. So I don't know.
So you'll be back eventually to talk about that.
Yeah, I guess my plug would be cool, stay in school. No, I don't know.
I love it.
That's a great plug, actually.
I have no idea.
Okay, guys, thanks for tuning in to our chat with Courtney Draper. We had an absolute blast talking with her. And, of course, as always, we hope to have her back on in the future.
And go bowling with her. Let's go bowling with her.
Yeah, Scott was like, come hang out with us. Let's go bowling. And I'm like, sure, I'm going to suck it up, but I'll go. It'll be fun.
You can't be worse than me. I'm sure the worst bowler alive.
Yeah, I'm pretty bad. We'll see.
She's professional, though. She's got her own gear. So.
I do have a quick bowling story. It was at Matt's bachelor party. I was bowling the best game of my absolute life. And, Matt had a little bit too much to drink, and he had ripped his pants.
Whoa. I was not at all drunk at that point.
I don't know, man. But you had a big hole in your pants. Had you soiled yourself at that point?
Oh, Jesus. If you're going to make up things, then what's the point in telling a story?
I remember some of that night.
The ripping of the pants is true. The soiling is not true, but
the drunkenness was later.
Later,
I did get extremely drunk, but it was much later.
I remember taking you home. I remember it was fun.
The good one, but anyway, I was bowling the best game of my life, and I was about to bowl like my I don't know. I think I was like about to bowl a turkey. Matt like ran up and like slapped me in the ass, or something. And it was a total gutter ball. And I was like, no, and I think that was the last time I bowled.
I also would stand. Like next to him while he was getting ready to bowl, and I would just stare at him and say things like really quietly while he was going to bowl down the alley. It was pretty.
Yeah, cool.
Are we helping or hurting our case to have Courtney Draper bowl with us right now?
We're probably hurting her.
Wait, is it really a thing that you're not supposed to bowl at the same time as the aisle?
It's a bowling etiquette.
Yeah,
yield to the right.
Like I never knew this, and then people started glaring at me.
Yeah,
and I'm like, what? We're just having fun.
Nope. Always serious competition.
Why are you trying to piss on our parade, bro? Just trying to have a good time. Just having fun.
Who's hung up on these rules things?
Just trying to have a good time, bro.
As always, you guys can find us on Twitter, at NerdAppropriate on Twitter. You can email us all directly, Matt, Scott, Hillary with one L, or Ash at NerdAppropriate.com. And you can find us on Facebook, / NerdAppropriate.
You know what?
What?
We recovered our goddamn YouTube account this week, so we're going to start doing stuff.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
We'll talk about that on the, sometime on the podcast.
We'll talk about that in the previous podcast, retrospectively.
Travel back in time and talk
about
that.
And go follow Courtney Draper on Twitter at Courtney_Draper. and tell her how awesome she is. Tell her to make more awesome games.
Yes, she's good people.
Yes.
As always, guys, thank you so much for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye, everyone.
You know, I love criminal law, and you can either be a prosecutor trying to lock a person up, mm-hmm. or you can be the defense attorney, you know, trying to basically get them off. Well, right. That sounds sexual, but you know what I mean? Like, trying to get them to not be put in jail.
How does one get a job doing that?
Oh, Ash, I thought you were just going to let it go.
Like, that's what I used to do on the streets before I became an actor. I was discovered.